Willkommen bei einer neuen Episode von Markenkraft. Für alle, die von Marken fasziniert und für ihr Wohlergehen verantwortlich sind. Welcome to another episode of Markenkraft. My name is Olaf Hartmann and today I have the honor of having Professor Jenny Romaniuk again on my podcast. Jenny is a research professor, international director of the Ehrenberg Bass Institute of the University of South Australia. The Ehrenberg Bass Institute is the largest marketing research center in the world, busting pseudoscience and marketing myths. They showed us with empirical research that brands need to be brain-friendly, meaning that we need to take the function of perception, memory, and retrieval as a basis to think about how we can make things grow. They urged marketers to focus on attracting light category buyers, showed them that greater loyalty amongst heavy users doesn't necessarily translate into market success, created some controversy with the stating that distinctiveness trumps differentiation, and even more provocatively, that behavior drives perception and not the other way around. In short, they challenged a lot of conventional marketing wisdom and continue to do so. Jenny wrote three highly influential books, How Brands Grow, Part 2, co-authored with Byron Sharp, Building Distinctive Brand Assets, and her newest, Better Brand Health, which we will talk about today. She's one of the leading researchers on brand equity, advertising effectiveness, distinctive brand assets, word of mouth, loyalty, brand growth, and pioneered mental availability measurements and metrics. Welcome back, Jenny. It is really great to have you on the show again.
Thank you. Great to be here.
For all listeners out there that want to learn more about Jenny's life and career start, which I have to advise is highly entertaining, I advise them to listen to our first conversation, episode 31, on the principles of brand growth, still one of the most popular episodes on Markenkraft. So Jenny, let's start with some basics. What is the difference between market research and marketing science? And why do we actually need marketing science?
Well, I mean, it's more about, it's not really that the difference is more about the how you use them, because a lot of what we do in market research can be, so science is a process for interpreting information. Market research is a way to get information. So you can interpret market research in the moment, or it can form part of a basis for a scientific inquiry into a phenomena. For example, you can, so say you're doing research into understanding your customers' use of generative AI. So you can just find out how many people in your category are adopting generative AI as part of their processes in the category, and you might get a figure of, say, 35%. So that's market research. But in that same questionnaire, you might ask some questions about testing different reasons why people might be using generative AI and testing some assumptions of what they're getting out of it, how they're finding the process and things like that. You gather that information and that helps you understand maybe why some things are happening. And you might then use that also then. You might have previously studied the adoption of other new technologies in your industry. And from that, you've then got a body of different studies that say when a new technology becomes available, this is how it gets adopted. These are the reasons why people do what they do. And you start to develop some facts about it. You know, you might discover women are more likely to take it on board than men first. Women lead the way. Or it might be the younger people in the organization are more likely to adopt it than the older people. After you've got those facts, that can then lead you to come to some conclusions about why it happens. Why might younger people be more likely to take on the technology? Is it because they're more open to new ideas? And then you can start to build that and answer that question why. But that process of accumulating bits of knowledge and get an understanding of the world, that's really what science is about. Market research is how you can get those bits of knowledge, but it's not the only way to do so.
Okay, so that basically means the quality of our thinking depends on the quality of our mental models and the precision of our data. So market research is about getting the data right, precise. And what you just described to me in my language would be that you create the framework within to apply the look at the data and generate useful knowledge for my marketing practice. So that is a good reason, because many people don't see a connection there, like marketing and science. Why do we need this? And so on. So I think it's important to talk about this, that what we need basically to be more effective is not only more data.
Yeah, no, it's about quality. I liken it to, so if you're building a house, you want to make sure you want to make sure you've got good quality materials, really good quality bricks, good steel for your framework, whatever you're doing, et cetera. Now, those things can be quality. You can have those quality ingredients and just have them sitting there and they can still be good. So you can have really good quality market research, and that's important for the moment of whatever interpreting. But you don't necessarily have to use it to build a house. That's actually a totally different process.
Or you can build a house which is very sturdy, but just doesn't serve the purpose of the people that want to live in the house. Yeah. And just,
what's happened now. See, the problem we have a lot now is that there's a lot of data out there, but more data is not better quality data. And people often assume big samples mean good. But, a biased sample is a biased sample, no matter how many people are part of it. Only getting a fraction of someone's buying doesn't tell you a lot about them. It only tells you about that fraction. So this is where you can have poor quality bricks won't make a good house, but just having a good quality brick doesn't mean you use it to build a house.
Right. So that's you're always very good at metaphors. I love that. So here we are talking about architecture, because science and practice are often considered unconnected by marketeers. Yeah, and like you have just started. We chatted before this program that you roll out worldwide, also to invite next to your sponsors, also CMOs or whoever wants to get an update on how to look at the factors that make brands grow. What do you find the most convincing argument, like, to make marketing science relevant in the boardroom, where they're busy with the nuts and bolts of everyday business and strategy? And why do we need marketing science? Doesn't this distract? Like, how do you explain it in a quick way?
Science is just about having the rigor to understand the decisions that you're making. Is it necessary? I don't know. I mean, if you think about someone who is a really great sculptor or painter or something, if you're in the art forms, a lot of good artists do understand science, because they understand the science of the materials they're working with and how they work and that sort of stuff, even though they're not developing science from their materials. But we have some basic laws that underpin different things that we do. So my question would be, would you trust an engineer that didn't understand, the laws of gravity and that? I'd be a little bit worried if my engineer didn't do that. Now, you might argue that then, and this goes back to the old debate of, is marketing an art or a science, and, sort of stuff. Nothing is a science, but you can apply a scientific process to it. Then the question is it useful to do so? Now, if after all these years we had applied a scientific process to marketing and got nothing, like, there is a world where we could be looking at how people buy across different categories and not see anything that's common. How you buy your toothpaste is totally different from how you buy your bottled water to how you buy your holidays. There could be nothing in common with those. We could have totally different processes, in which case applying a scientific process would reveal no similarities. And that would be important information, but it wouldn't help us Give us a very solid foundation. We would always constantly, with every category, have to come up with a new framework for it. But the fact that at least about sort of 40 or 60 years of marketing science has brought us some really strong empirical laws that still hold today, that's pretty amazing. So you can choose to ignore that and just go about your business. But why would you? Why would you not take advantage of really cool knowledge that helps you make smarter decisions?
And yeah, that totally makes sense. And again, the metaphor of the artist, you know, if the artist ignores the laws of perspective, for example, and his aim is to recreate like a more naturalistic painting, and he ignores the laws of perspective, then he's not going to arrive at his goal. If other artists ignore like the laws of perception, there's a similarity there, you know, like the op art that is using our perception system and understands that certain colors next to each other, they start to oscillate, and if they don't know that, then they can't use it. So there we got a good connection. So it makes sense, like to look at these empirical laws. So because you are applying these empirical laws now to measure brand health and brand strength, so I think it's good for those listeners that haven't listened to the first episode to do a small recap. Okay, so what are the empirical laws that you discovered? And you're wonderful in summarizing them in how brands grow, easy to find, easy to mind, easy to find. So mental and physical availability. And you are always great in storytelling. And in your new book, you have this wonderful story of you and your niece at home. And that explains in a great way, what are category entry points? What is mental availability? What is physical availability? So maybe you want to share that story with us.
Yeah, well, so category entry points are essentially the thoughts that people have in their lives when they transition from being a person to being a category buyer. And I really want people to understand that moment, because I think what often happens is it's like we classify someone as a category buyer and like they've got an always on switch. But they're not really, even if I, you know, I'm a coffee buyer, but I'm not right now because, first of all, I'm talking to you. So you would think it was weird if I just slipped off and went coffee. You're drinking coffee right now, but also it's the afternoon. I don't drink coffee in the afternoon generally. So sort of thing. But there will be times when my coffee buying brain gets switched on, and how I come into that will depend on a whole heap of things around. So the example in the book was that, you know, one time I was having dinner and we were ordering in, and it was a winter's night. I was not feeling that great. You know, I was kind of a little bit, you know, when you get in winter, you get that bit of allergy that you're not sick, but you're not well. And my niece was over. And so those are three different areas of category entry points, actually four if you count dinner as well, that led to us deciding what we were going to order in terms of delivery. Now,
I think that is something very important to stress here. You just said several category entry points. And I find that often the misunderstanding that people think there's only one category entry point, but there are, like you just described, there is your, like your physical state is a category entry point that influences your choice. Mm-hmm. Your niece being there is a category entry point. I have guests. That's my category entry points about the food. And it's a winter's night. So, you know, so certain foods. Sorry, I didn't want to disturb you, but I find that in conversations about category entry points, that's a super common misunderstanding that they think, okay, we need to focus on one category entry point. But in the same situation, there are several mental category entry points.
Yeah, and it even goes further than that because each of those category entry points will come up for me again. So since then, we've had other winters. So it's been cold and I've been in environments that have been cold. I've had other days where I've not felt great. And I've had other dinners with my niece. But those three things together haven't necessarily come up. But if you know how often these things happen, even if I tell you that, you could probably, well, we probably don't know my relationship with my niece, but you could probably assume that, you know, winters always going to keep coming up. So that's probably the most common. Probably second most common would be me having dinner with my niece, and because I'm not a person who gets sick very often, so sort of thing. So out of those, they don't equally come up all the same time. They don't equally come up multiple times, but they will come up in partnership with other category entry points at different points in time. So when people try to do like driver modeling and go, this is the category entry point that defined we bought, it's actually a really futile endeavor, because it's never one thing. It's always this combination of bits that come together in the moment for the choice.
And so for me as a marketeer, it's more important to know which one has the greatest economic value. You like it just which reoccurs most often or more, more steadily. So that's economically much more important to come up in those moments than in others, which don't arrive so often.
Scale across the market is more important than effect on an individual, because effects on individuals are so variable and intangible that it's very hard to reliably ascertain them. Because if you say, if you ask somebody what's important, the answer will always be, it depends. And as long as the answer is it depends, it's really hard to model it. Any answer someone gives you in the moment won't necessarily hold the next time that person's in the moment. So we've got to let go of this idea that we can control these outcomes and we can predict these outcomes. The best thing we can do is try to get the odds on our side by focusing on more common category entry points that are likely to be used by a wide range of people, such that, because if more people use it, we know there's a very strong relationship between how many people use a category entry point and how often they're used. So those that are more popular across people, within that, those people tend to use it more often than other category entry points as well. But there are multiple that can be used by a person at one point in time and over time as well.
Okay, great. That is very valuable to clear it up. What I achieved by disturbing you is that your story has been broken about your niece being there on the winter night. So let's go back there. You're not in a good shape. It's winter. Your niece is there, mm-hmm. and you're thinking about dinner.
Yeah. We've got to order dinner. And so that then puts a few different things on the table, in that, there's things my niece likes and doesn't like, which often I have difficulty keeping up with. I was feeling more comfort foodie, wanting something really thing. So we ended up getting burgers. And that was the thing that we ended up doing. And we got from a burger place that does big burgers and got it delivered and all is good. But that moment has never happened again, even though those individual components that have happened multiple times. So, and this is, if someone was trying to create a statistical model to predict what we were going to buy on that occasion, well, good luck to you, but it's a pretty useless model, because those conditions don't happen again. So this is where I see a lot of misuse of category entry points, because people really don't understand how memory works. And I just wish it was a requirement of all marketing courses to teach people about how memory works, because that's the big part of our job. We're either changing the environment to try and work in our favor, or changing our memories to try and work in our favor.
Right. And was there like the burger that you chose? Was there like, can we talk about a little bit about mental availability of that burger chain and the physical availability of this? Was there like a convenience influencing that choice?
It was actually
taste? Uber Eat. Okay.
It was on Uber Eat. So that was the distribution outlet, because it was
easy to find.
So it was one of the ones that was on there, and I can't even remember what it was, because we buy from multiple repertoire. We have a multiple repertoire of burgers that you can get there.
No brand love involved.
No. I didn't. Yes. I mean, don't get me wrong. My stomach was very happy at the end of the burger. In fact, if I remember rightly, it was too big. Yeah. When you get a burger that's so big that you feel like you should be sharing it with a family of four, because it's huge. That was my one memory of it. It was just a bit too big, but I can't even remember who it was from. I'd have to look at my phone.
So the physical availability at that moment was the decisive point more than the mental availability of the brand of the burger.
Well, yeah? Yes and no. I mean, the thing is, as we look down the list, each of them evoke their own memories. But yes, if they were not physically on the Uber Eats site, they had no chance of being bought. And actually we did have a burger chain that we both liked that did actually was no longer on the site, and that meant we obviously wouldn't get that. We just went through. But so and this is where sort of the memory and the environment entwine. So we'll have, you know, this, and talk through different things, and I might say something about it and she might say something, and all of it's based on our memories of our past experience, whether they're accurate or not. We assume they're accurate. Sometimes they might not be. It's easy to get when you've got things like Burger Tech and Burger City and, you know, all these brand names that all basically sound the same that come through. And then I also have the issue of I'm gluten intolerant. So any burgers that didn't have a gluten-free option, then they would immediately discard it because they're not going to get penetration from me because I can't eat them. So, you know, so all of those things come into play of mental and physical availability. And it's really impossible to discern what was the deciding factor that made us go for this particular one.
Okay. And the marketeers, nevertheless, want to know, what do we need to push? What do we need to improve to be more often chosen in these situations? So before we dive into, because that brings us to measuring. Okay, so we learned the more category entry points we are available, the better the chance of retrieval, the better the chance of being chosen. But if the physical availability is not connected with it, you like the burger chain, but it's not there, so it's not going to be chosen. So, but that's what we're going to come back to when we talk about your book. I would like to cover two more basics before. Is like the one thing that got the marketing community very upset, because it's like almost a belief system about differentiation. What is your view on that? Like, where you say distinctiveness is more important than differentiation, and what does it have to do with category entry points?
Yeah, this is it's an interesting argument, because I think people a lot of times have got it wrong, in that people assume it's an argument between differentiation and distinctiveness only, but it's not. See, the core of differentiation, which comes from economics, is this basic thing, is that you as a brand offer something that no one else offers, so it's unique to you, or you offer something much better than everyone else, so you're superior in a way that then, and that thing has to be something customers value such that they will differentially prefer you over alternatives. And the payoff of that is that you can then raise your price. And they will. Some people will go, no, I'm still going to buy that because you offer this.
It's so different.
I can't get this anywhere else, and I really want this. So that's a mix of two things going on there. One is, are you the same as other brands? And the other is, do you have what consumers want? And often people think those need to be intertwined, but they don't. So distinctiveness addresses the issue of, are you the same as other brands? So you know how I was joking about, well, there's Burger Tech, Burger City, all these brands that look
not
the
distinct,
same.
Not distinct.
Yeah, it's I like can't
all,
tell
all about burger.
Big. But if Burger Tech was red and Burger City was blue, or, you know, they had different colors, different logos, things like that. You know, I don't get McDonald's and Burger King mixed up because they have very different brand identities. Right? So that's the distinctiveness. And the advantage of distinctiveness is you can trademark it, you can protect against it. Now, you can, in some industries, trademark and protect a thing of differentiation. Pharma is a very good example of that. You have patents for pharmaceuticals that protect companies from doing that. But the vast majority of brand launches aren't new technology that's patentable, or if it is, the cost of doing it is just not worth it. And so what happens is you might launch a new innovation, and before you know it, other people are copying you pretty quickly beyond this. So it's not sustainable.
But if we connect that with what we just discussed, like the technical differentiation, what you just said is almost impossible besides pharmaceutical patents. And that also runs out after 20 years. But what we just discussed with that burger thing is like more like a relative differentiation in memory structures. So what do you remember?
Yeah. So that then comes to the second point is, so how do you know if a burger company has what it is you're looking for as a customer? And that's where the category entry points come in, and you go, does it sell what I'm looking for? Does it fit into what it is? And so, yes. So I might know that this particular brand has gluten-free buns. That's a bit of information I've got in my head, so I might go there first to check to see. There might be another brand that has gluten-free buns, but I don't know that. And so unless the one that has gluten-free buns, for some reason I don't want that, I might not go down and find the one unless they've somehow advertised me to say, hey, we've got gluten-free buns. I actually now, whenever I go, because in Europe, for example, McDonald's sometimes has gluten-free buns. So I often will go in and just search the menu just to see if this is a McDonald's that has this, because we don't have it in Australia. And then if it is there, I will often buy McDonald's, even though actually I'm not a big fan of McDonald's, but it feels like a treat because I can never have it except for when I'm in a place with gluten-free buns.
And at that point, it's relatively superior in your memory structure. You are in Europe, you need orientation, and there's a difference with the McDonald's to other burger chains, because your memory structure is about they might have gluten-free burgers. So yeah, doesn't that marry that conflict? I think it mends the conflict.
Yes. So I'm uncomfortable calling it superiority simply because it's about the salience of the memory structures. And that also varies over time. It's not a constant. Mm-hmm. So we're very good at forgetting stuff. Mm. And so, you know, so it's very easy for it to not go in, which is different from this idea that I buy this because it's the best.
It's the only one and nobody else can offer this.
Yeah, or I buy this because, yes, it's the only one that offers. Yeah, if there was only one brand that offered gluten-free buns, that would be a different.
Yeah, that would be amazing. Okay, but that is difficult to sustain.
But now lots of brands do. In fact, last time I went to Finland, Burger King had gluten-free buns as well as McDonald's. And I actually ended up going to Burger King because that was physically closer to my hotel. I couldn't find the McDonald's. So all of these things come into play. But that's where people have gone wrong in this differentiation distinctiveness. They think it's just all about differentiation versus distinctiveness and assume that if it's just about looking different and it doesn't matter what you offer. No, you still have to offer something relevant. It's just you don't have to offer something unique. It's good enough for it to be relevant and salient to the buyer.
And the distinctiveness assures that the memory structures about the relevant associations are retrieved more quickly or more easily and more often. And there we have then a superiority. I know you don't like the word, but the superiority in the retrieval, like it's just stronger. It's just stronger and more often comes to mind. If we could define it like that, then I think
the value of that of it also helps you embed the memories down, because if you use your distinctive assets right, your advertising should be better branded. So it's going into that part of the brain. And so, you know, when we have a strong brand identity, it just means everything is sort of supercharged to always go to the right part of the brain and have a greater chance of success, assuming what it is you're building is actually useful. And that's where the premise comes in, that you need to have the role of category entry points is about saying, make sure the memories you build through your communications are actually things that people would benefit from remembering.
Right, right. My last question before we dive, now we have basically laid the groundwork of what we want to measure. Yeah, so, but just one last question there. Is it actually Can you actually, when people talk about it, own a category entry point in your view?
No. We've done a lot of R&D in this. Well, not only can you not own it, you actually don't need to. Yeah, you can't. So we've tested whether or not you can have unique associations in people's heads. So you're the only brand linked to something, to category entry point. And the answer is no. About for any one brand on any one category entry point, it's typically about 2% of people have one brand, have a single brand, have a specific brand linked to a category entry point. If you calculate it across all buyers and category entry points across all brands, so this is distributed, it's about 30%. So you think of it, it's about 20% have no brands linked to a category entry point, about 50% have multiple brands linked to a category entry point, and about 30% have one brand linked, but that one brand is each are different brands. The maximum we found, I think, was 20% for a specific brand on a specific category entry point. No brand reached 50% of it.
Right.
So unique associations are rare. Big brands don't need to differentially own a category entry point. Big brands have wider, fresher networks, and they tend to have more mental advantages, not narrow cast on one. They're known for lots of things, not just one. That's why they're big. In fact, what we find is the more you use a category entry point, the more brands you have associated with it.
Right. And so that ties in very well with why heavy users is not the source of growth, because the heavy users, they have a wide variety of brands that they choose from anyway. And to make them like use your brand a little bit more often is like heavy work because of the mental competition. But a light buyer that has a very small, maybe also memory set about the category, will always choose the archetype cola. Yeah, like for example, like if I drink cola,
brand.
I immediately think of Coca-Cola. And to make this tangible for the listeners, Coca-Cola is a good example, because Coca-Cola is memory structures about being on the beach in the sun. It's about meeting friends. It's about eating. It's about Christmas trucks. It's about, so just all these things that we can immediately think of are all category entries. I might drink Coca-Cola at Christmas at the table. I might drink Coca-Cola in the summer when I do party on the beach. This shows why the brand is also so strong worldwide. Fantastic. So let's dive into your...
Can I just add one more thing?
Yeah.
And that is that, yes, and the other thing in the icing of the cake in this is that heavy category buyers tend to use more category entry points.
Right.
So if you want to get a big amount of purchases from a heavy category buyer, say that was your desire, you can't do that by only focusing on one category entry point, because they don't focus on just one category entry point. The more times they engage with a category, the more category entry points. So we're always about the more we do something, the wider spread our activity. So the idea of owning something, it's not only unnecessary, it's just illogical.
Right. And that, but on the other hand, that doesn't mean that all communication must cover always all category entry points. You know, there's always limited budget, and you might decide what we just discussed, the economically most valuable category entry point is this season my focus to be more present, because we have a weakness there. Like many people have this category entry point, and I could choose as a strategy to strengthen my mental availability for that category entry point, but not do everything at the same time, because then you spread the butter thin. Yeah.
Well, so there's different challenges with that. And there's actually some R&D we're doing now about understanding, we call it from copy to brain, understanding how associations are actually built through advertising, which seems like something we should know. But I see so many ads where I go, I have no idea what you want me to change, but how you want me to change my brain. And I'm willing to change my brain in results your ad, but I have no idea with what you've just presented to me, how that is supposed to work and that is useful for you. But often what happens is people confuse the short term with the long term. So in the short term, for one execution, you maybe only have one message, but that doesn't mean you have to commit to that one message forever and always to the rest of your life. you can have different messages for different executions. So when we do category entry point studies for companies, we provide them with, at the end of it, what we call the long shortlist. Because we're going to call it the shortlist, but people think a shortlist is very short, but this is actually the long shortlist. So it's usually about sort of 5 to 8 category entry points that are viable options for the brand to be able to communicate. And then say, here's your next 10 years of communication. You've got 5 to 8. These things don't move very much because our lives are usually pretty static in how they interact with the category. When we've tracked category entry point usage over time, they tend to be quite stable. They don't zoom up and down a lot. So this is things that you can rotate between over time and know these are always, if you get this into people's brains, this is really useful for them and it's really useful for your brand.
And you see how useful marketing science is, because it makes it less complex, because internally, often after a while, people get bored with their own communication and they want to change something. Mm-hmm. And before, when you quantified it and you have a solid mental model to think about this, okay, this is what we need to strengthen. And the applause the big brands deserve often is not even about this ingenious creative strategy, but also their perseverance of always pushing the same category entry points or the same message for a very, very long time. Because of our memory structures, look, you always say the natural state of the brain is decay, and
our brains are staying there fine, but memory is what decays.
Oh, sorry, yes, yeah, not the, but the brain also, like, over the lifetime, it does decay a little bit. Yeah, yeah, it loses, but you're right, the memory,
memories is what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the actual physical state of your brain molding and.
Absolutely. So we overestimate how quickly people learn. And I see that with my wife when I go to town and come back and say, like, oh, there's this new shop here on the corner. And she says, like, yeah, this has been there for 3 years. Yeah. So, and I've been driven by so often, and just after 3 years, finally it registered with me. So now we have laid the groundwork. Okay. So this is how we understand how brands grow. And now let's look at, why did you feel it necessary to write this great book on brand health?
Yeah, this was, it probably should have been my first book, but I had to write a couple to get the capability to do it, because it was a hard book to write. It was my COVID baby, essentially. And I started at the same time as, so Magda, who you've had on the podcast, she had her first child during COVID. And I started the book about the same time as she first got pregnant. Well, let's just say Ollie was 18 months before I finished the book. So gestation period was a lot longer than hers in terms of getting it out, because it was just, I wanted to make brand health tracking interesting, even though it's quite a geeky thing to do. And a lot of what I had to say was quite nerdy and geeky, in that it was about measurement and scales and background and understanding and things like that. And I also wanted to have that fine line between it being quite practical and tactical for someone designing a questionnaire, but still having the big picture of, why are we doing this all in the first place? What's the purpose of these measures? And the reason I did it was because there was nothing out there that, to me, had put this together. And because I'd spent close to a decade researching different parts of brand health tracking, because I used to manage some brand health trackers. We used to do this. We still do a little bit of it at the Institute, but when we first started, it was one of the biggest sources of revenue that we had when we were sort of starting out as what was then the Marketing Science Center. And I became uncomfortable about how much I didn't know about what I was measuring. So we were sort of handed this questionnaire with these measures that all looked familiar. I mean, I knew what brand awareness was, what brand image was, what all of these different things were. But when things changed, it was like, okay, well, I assume that's because of this, and maybe that's because of this, and sort of stuff. And it just made me uncomfortable how much I didn't know. And then when I looked for answers in there, I couldn't find them. So over the decade, I got different researchers. I managed to convince them to research different parts of the tracker. So I had someone look at just negative perception, someone else look at brand awareness, someone else looking at light buyers, someone else looking at what's the best way to measure brand and category usage, all quite nerdy type of things, but things that, I really couldn't see any information on. And so this was, and then I'd had conversations with different people about different parts of it. And this was then pulling it together into so that someone could see at least the bulk of what we did. I couldn't fit everything in there, but at least the bulk of what we did over time. And because some of it was quite old, I actually redid some of the studies to check to see that they still held today. I mean, some of them, God forbid, were done in times when we were collecting data by telephone, like calling people up and interrupting their dinner and asking them about things. So, those studies I redid to check to see I was still confident in the knowledge there. So all of that took quite a bit of time to do.
Wow. Okay, but that's very important information. So how many PhDs went into the book? How many researchers in total?
I would say there's probably at least 10.
Right. So it's a collective effort and you put it together.
Absolutely. And, yeah. It's quite a long reference list.
I have to say it's not like the regular thriller you read to fall asleep, but I have to say for the nerdiness and the depth that you have covered, as I said, you are great in telling stories and making it very tangible. And we'll try at the end of the podcast to follow a little bit. I have a little experiment for you because I know you've done a lot of work also in the financial industry. Yeah, banks and so on. So we'll just try to apply roughly like the customer journey to a bank and then see, okay, so how does this turn up in our measurement and how can it take that? But before that, can you share what in your view are the biggest faults that people just make in brand tracking? What is the problem with the brand tracking out there at the moment?
Okay, so it's a couple of problems. So one is not fit for purpose. And that is because a lot of our trackers and a lot of our measures that are in trackers were developed in time before we knew how brands grow. In fact, some of them were developed before we really understood how the brain works. So just for context, so things like brand awareness, brand image as concepts were developed in the 1950s and 60s, and they sort of came out of cognitive psychology at the time that was very influential in marketing. And so things like attitude, we were talking about painting earlier. So the word attitude actually comes from painting. It's the way your body is placed. Are you placed side on or front on is the attitude of the person in a painting. And so that sense of a person's orientation was adopted by cognitive psychologists to talk about how they felt about something. Do you feel positively or do you feel negatively? Is your attitude to an idea? Same with salience. That also came from painting. It's are you in the foreground or in the background and the perspective side of it. That was adopted in there is, are you in the foreground of someone's memory or in the background of someone's memory? And so that's how awareness measures were first developed. And the idea of top of mind awareness is something that's in the foreground of someone's memory as opposed to being in the background of someone's memory. So we're even influenced by the art, via cognitive psychology, art is influencing science.
And like you said before, it's such a young science. Marketing science has lent from so many other science, which some of them are thousands of years old.
I don't know if you have a chance to see. I do an article for a column for Media Cat. And my last one, I had fun reimagining if famous scientists were actually marketers, how would their works be interpreted in a marketing front? And famous thinkers. It wasn't just scientists, but it was just a bit of fun I was having of just playing around with some ideas of if Newton, instead of developing the laws, if Einstein, instead of developing the law of relativity, had come up with the theory of retailing, what would his equation look like. So yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Can we link that? Is it possible to link in the show notes?
Yeah, it's on LinkedIn. So yes, I can get you that. Okay. But yeah, it's just the philosophy science geek in me and the marketing geek in me came together in that for fun.
But then
if you think about things like the knowledge of memory and how that works, that actually wasn't really incorporated into branding until the sort of late 80s going into the 90s.
Yeah, and we've learned so much more in the last 20 years because of also, some brain imaging technology, but the neuroscience has advanced so much in explaining. That doesn't mean that the practitioners did everything wrong before, but often it was just
not
confirmed.
Not why they were doing it. So the idea of differentiation was actually popularized in the 1970s, particularly by Theodore Levitt and sort of thing. So you've got these ideas that predate our knowledge. Now, that doesn't mean they're wrong, but it does mean we have to go, this is what we know now. Now what we know, how does this knowledge look? And then think about, well, do we have to either abandon it, reimagine it, or think about how it might, what sort of role, maybe a reduced role that it plays in the whole process?
So you see things like old mental models influencing brand tracking today, and they are based on faulty assumptions. Could you give one example? What you still see in brand trackers, which is just doesn't have a place?
Unaided awareness and top of mind awareness, which is, one of the most common metrics out there. So brand awareness is about the link between the brand and the category cue. And often, so there's two things it's used for, and often these things are muddled up. One is to know what you sell. So if I'm an insurance company, say, and I launch a pet insurance brand, I have to communicate to people, hey, I sell pet insurance. If you're thinking about pet insurance, I've got something like the example of the gluten-free bun type of thing, but this is like for whole categories here. Okay, so, and if you're a new brand, you're a new insurance brand that's come in pet insurance, you have to communicate to people, hey, we sell insurance. An example I give is if I said, avocado, what would you think of?
Vegetable. Is it a vegetable? Is it a fruit?
Technically, I don't know. Because it's got a seed in it.
That's right. It's a fruit.
Yeah. Well, actually, so you're not thinking of mattresses.
No.
But there is a brand in the US called Avocado Green that sells mattresses. So they have to work to put you in their brand in the mattress part of your brain. Because if you just see avocado somewhere, you're probably thinking, oh, Mexican would be nice tonight. Guacamole would be great. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing. And then the other part of brand awareness that is often used is this idea of assessing retrievability. How easy is something coming out of memory? And that's why we use unaided awareness or top of mind, which is the idea you're the first one out of memory. Mm-hmm. Now, before we knew how memory worked, that kind of made sense. You have, is it in memory? And how easily does it come out? Because people use the category cue, then they evaluate the items that are retrieved, and then they choose something from there, which is your classic AIDA type of model of how brands work.
Meaning there's an assumption when I come in the mind first, I'm also have a higher probability of being bought.
Yeah, but the what makes you come into the mind is your link to the category cue. Mm-hmm. But in reality, what we know is it's not just, so I didn't sit here with my niece and go, oh, gee whiz, we need some options for dinner. What can we think of? Oh, okay, yeah. And then out of that, start evaluating. Actually, our brain shortcuts it and goes, I know how you're feeling. I know where you are. I know your niece is here. Here's a couple of options that I think are going to suit you right now.
And there we are at the category entry points, not the category.
That's what shaped retrieval. Now, of course, I still have to know that brand offers dinner, because if I come to mind, something else, and I'm not sure if it sells that, although it's more likely it just wouldn't come to mind because it wouldn't be linked to the category. But that's the poor use of brand awareness measures, in that it's useful for knowing, do people know what you sell, but it's not very good ease of retrieval because it's using the wrong cue. And it's also assuming one measure captures all the retrievability. Whereas you have brands that, for example, might be good for kids, but not for adults, might be nice as a treat, but not great for every day. You know, brands have mental advantages and disadvantages that mean that that's why, part of the reason why we have repertoires that we have, because as our lives change, we might have different things that our brain considers more appropriate at that time.
So the first thing that we take out, we need to check every measurement that we have in our brand tracking, look if it's still relevant with the current state of science. And because otherwise we gather data, and we have 200, like you say, 200 slide decks, and our decision
makers
are...
But this is a classic example when you look at something like brand awareness. When you look, you'd think, we've been tracking brand awareness since the 1950s. If it was useful, surely someone would have found a relationship now. But there are actually no documented relationships with it. And the ones that have some relationship are usually flawed because they don't take into account brand usage, and you have that usage bias. So we can take something that is, although brand awareness is quite easy, as a measure it's quite complicated because it's prompted and unprompted and three measured metrics you get out of it, and go, really, out of this, what's the most important thing to know? Well, the people who buy you, they obviously know what you sell. So if I buy pet insurance from my insurance company, I obviously know they sell pet insurance, because otherwise what'd I buy? But it's the people who don't buy pet insurance from me, they're the ones I want to know. Do they know I sell pet insurance? You might not have bought from me, but do you know at least I do that? So it's actually the prompted awareness from non-buyers that is actually the really important metric we get out of that.
And not the overall brand awareness. So there we have the source of growth.
That's contaminated by usage. And so what happens is big brands look good, small brands don't look as good, but that's because you've got users in there that score close to 100%. The only reason they don't get 100% is sometimes you have a few holdouts in there, but you know, it's pretty much you've hit the ceiling. So we need to take them out of the metric because they're just stopping us from seeing what the real battle is. And for big brands, maybe everyone does know. So if you are San Pellegrino, probably not a big brand, but you know, if you're San Pellegrino, maybe all non-buyers know you sell sparkling water. Great, cool. Then that's not a problem for you. But if you're San Pellegrino, and even if that's the case, you might be looking at some of these other new water brands and checking to see, have they got momentum? Are more people learning about them and learning what they sell, which might indicate they're going to be a competitive threat?
For example, Liquid Death has opened up a new category entry point by like not making a fool of yourself in an environment where everybody else is drinking alcohol. That is a completely new category entry point for water. So I need a can which looks like heavy metal, like I'm a really bad guy, but I'm actually just drinking water in an environment where everybody is partying up.
And I mean, you've seen the, I mean, I particularly like, from a category entry point perspective, the Heineken Now You Can campaign, where they have like the guy who's at work and he turns around after doing a great presentation and opens up the Heineken and starts drinking it, and everyone's looking shocked and he thinks it's because the beer, and he like no points out that it's 0% alcohol, but it's just because it's gone onto his personal photos in the back of him, sort of stuff. But I think they're funny, but they also highlight that now non-alcoholic beer, you can drink it at work, which is a category entry point you would never have had for beer. Most organizations frown on drinking beer in the workplace.
And the McDonald's campaign, which you probably loved, is the one with the eyebrows, which, you know, the where there's this great song. Who's it from? From this Swiss brand. It's just these girls that communicate without saying that they want to go to McDonald's by raising their eyebrows. Raising the eyebrows. So they created they use the distinctive asset of the McDonald's logo, which you could see as eyebrows, and basically signal, do you want to go to McDonald's in the office at noon, which is kind of a new category entry point, because not many people say this is like something which comes to mind.
You'd be surprised. My nieces, when they went to school, sometimes at school, People would Uber Eats McDonald's to get delivered to the school.
At lunch. Yeah. But okay, if it is already in this category, then it strengthens that point that
exactly.
I can go out with my widespread. with my colleagues, I can go out and have fun mm-hmm. at noon. Yeah. So
exactly.
that's a good
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's a good example. Then thank you very much. That makes it. And the book is so deep, so we're not going to cover everything. But I can just advise everybody: this is the way every measurement is looked at and really checked. And you give very also tactical advice, which I appreciated a lot. It's not only the big overflight. Yeah, we need to improve here things, and this is the principle to think about it. But really, you go down even to the way of phrasing the questions to mm-hmm. actually measure what it should measure. And I would go to one question which is often used in market research is like purchase intention. Like, mm-hmm. Can we measure purchase intention? Is it at the moment the way we measure it? Is it right?
Well, we can measure purchase intention. People do. Question is, what are we measuring when we're doing this? And the answer is we're pretty much measuring the past, not the future. So we're measuring a combination of how people feel about something. So it's an attitudinal measure. It's not a behavioral measure, but it's also when people are drawing from it, they're usually drawing from the past, not the future. Now, that's different from a purchase probability measure. So in the book, I contrast that with a Juster scale, which was developed by a gentleman called Thomas Juster out of the economics government department in the US. So he was in the department that was charged with measuring consumer confidence, which part of it is usually done by the people's likelihood of measure of buying durables. Because things like fridges and washing machines are often not essential in that you have to do it. If people think they're going to be up, getting a new fridge, washing machine, it's usually a sign they feel confident in their job and their position because they feel like they could spend, a couple of $100 on these things that are not kind of essential things. But what he noticed when they did follow-up studies was that the biggest amount of purchases that actually happened, so they followed up people and said, did you actually buy a fridge or a washing machine, et cetera, came from people who said they had no intention of buying it. And he went, okay, that's a problem. And the reason was quite simply because of the way the question was asked. The question when you ask about intent is about, basically, do you have plans to do something? And so when you ask people, do you have plans to buy a new fridge? A lot of people go, no. But if you ask people, what's your likelihood of buying a new fridge? Then they start to think about and go, it has been making a few noises. And I was over my friends last week and they had this cool ice machine that came out. And I hear, and then you start thinking, well, I don't have any plans to do it, but there's probably, say, a 3 out of 10 chance that I could do it.
Right. And the one is a digital measurement, 0 or 1, and the other one is like, there's more tendency.
Yeah, usually purchase intent is measured on like a 5-point scale from definitely will to definitely will not. And then there's like maybe will. There's different words that people use for it in the middle, but it's basically possibly will, might or might not, possibly won't, and definitely will not. That's usually your typical sort of intention scale, even though there are variations on that. But the Juster scales are specifically worded 11-point scale. It makes no assumptions that you've got something latent in your head. It asks you essentially to do an on-the-spot calculation based on the information that you know. And I think one of the best examples you can do that, if you ask somebody, do you intend to get sick next winter? And I'll go, well, no. What's your probability of getting sick? And people will adjust it. So if you've got kids, they're disease vectors and you've got a higher likelihood of getting sick. If you're just naturally someone who gets sick, if you're planning to go to Spain for the winter and totally avoid it, you probably think I've got a very low chance of getting sick. So all of those things get factored into an individual's assessment. And while it's not perfect, the answer is never wrong. So if you say 8 out of 10 probability, if you do it, you're right because you said there was 8 out of 10 chance. But if you don't do it, you're also right because you said there was a 2 in 10 chance you were not going to do that behavior. So it's about assessing the likelihoods of this. And I think, you know, marketers need to get a little bit more comfortable with probabilities and likelihoods because we don't have certainties. I can't definitely predict what someone will do. But when I look at something like the justice scale, I can go that those people who said sort of nine, more of them are likely to engage in it than the people who said two or three.
So it's like more like a proportion. It's more like precision guessing, but it remains guessing, it's like putting a funnel in front of the target.
An assessment where people can interpret. And I mean, people have tried to do this with intention measures. We know, for example, intention measures are more accurate when you ask about a very specific behavior. So it's not about, so if I said to you, you know, what's your intention to go to church? You'll give me an answer. But if I say that, you know, may or may not be correct. But if I say to you, what's your intention to go to church this Sunday at 10 a.m., you can give me a more accurate answer because you know, first of all, you might not go to church, in which case you get no chance, irrespective. But if you do sometimes go to church, you'll be able to go, okay, oh, no, this Sunday, 10 a.m., that's when my kid plays soccer or football, so I know I'm not going to church at that time, and you can give me a reasonable answer.
That makes complete sense because it makes it more tangible, the costs and benefits involved. Like
you're time sensitive because the data is only as good as this Sunday. So it has to be a short time frame. Because if I ask you about Sunday in October,
it needs to be immediate. The imagination.
It doesn't deliver
a picture.
Yeah. So we're better at giving assessments when the thing we're going to assess is very concrete, very short term, and that's not very useful from a research perspective. Whereas probabilities give us an assessment at an aggregate level and give us more time to be able to do it, to understand it. They're not perfect. Nothing ever will be, but it's better. It's a step up.
Yeah. And this is not applicable for brand tracking probably, but probably for proposition testings, for example. Like if you want to see, does the proposition make it more probable that the customer will take the next step towards purchase? Yeah. And the next step looks different for different groups, you know, like the next step for the one person is, yes, I will inform myself about the product. And the third one, yes, I'm going to sign the contract. Yeah. So it depends on where they are in the customer journey, the concrete description, very short term, what are you going to do next, will deliver more precise information than
possibly. I actually wouldn't bother about it. My sense of it is it's often used as a crutch in trackers so that people feel like there's a behavioral outcome.
Right. Let's get out of the nerdy corner again and step into the helicopter again now on the brand tracking. So if you could give tips, like what are we looking for in the brand tracker to see if our brand becomes stronger? What are the key points? We don't want a 200-slide presentation. We want crisp and precise measurements to look at, and then the management has a good basis on decide what are we going to do next. What are we looking for?
I can't answer that as concretely as you'd like, because the answer is it depends on context. So this is why I developed the mantra to kind of put in people's heads, what do you do for good tracking? And that is, first of all, design for the category. Mm-hmm. So you should design a tracker that anyone in your category could use, whether they're bigger brands, small brands, private labels, doesn't matter. They would all be quite happily to use your tracker. If you looked at your tracker and went, oh, you know, a private label wouldn't use this because I'm not including the major private label brands, then you've got a flaw in your tracker. You're getting biased results. So that's your first thing. Second thing is you need to analyze for the buyer. Because the biggest difference between people giving a response and not giving a response is whether or not they've got past experience buying the brand. Okay, that's the biggest difference. Often we do cuts where we might look at differences between gender and age groups. Dirty little secret, most of those differences are just because you've changed the usage base of it. And if you actually control for usage base, they're actually very similar to each other. So that's the thing. So analyze for the buyer, expect that buyers will score you higher on everything. And in fact, if they don't, if you have a metric where buyers and non-buyers are equal, you should really ask yourself, what am I measuring here? Because it should be a norm. And that translates into the third part of it, which is reporting for the brand. Because the biggest difference in interpreting things is big brands score differently than small brands do. We know this behaviorally when it comes to loyalty from Double Jeopardy. This also translates into brand health metrics. So more people will be aware of a big brand than a small brand. So you shouldn't judge them equally. You should judge them in line with their size.
Right. And Double Jeopardy for the people that no, just Double Jeopardy law means big brands, the buyers think.
Well, actually, Double Jeopardy, remember, is a tale told from the perspective of a small brand. So small brands suffer twice. They have many fewer users who are slightly less loyal. So when you're evaluating loyalty, if you're a small brand, you will have lower loyalty than a big brand will. And it's partly a function of your customer base. If you're a small brand, you tend to attract heavy category buyers because they're the ones who tend to buy small brands. They have split repertoires because they also buy the big brands. So more of your buyers also buy the big brands if you're a small brand, whereas lots of the big brands' buyers do not buy the small brands. So
great. So let's, I totally understand that you say I can do an overall very precise, but that's great. So design for the category, analyze for the buyer, and measure.
I can give you an example if we look at mental availability metrics of how they vary. So in mental availability metrics, we have four metrics that underpins. We have the mental market share, which is the main metric, and then we have three underlying metrics. Also, we have brand users and non-users. So technically, you could have a suite that is 12 metrics. But the good news is you don't need that. Because mental market share as a metric is relevant to both buyers and non-buyers. So you can just track that overall.
Okay. Definition for
the mental market share is the share that your brand, so if you take a representative set of brands that cover most of the market, doesn't have to be a census, it should cover most of it though, should cover the big brands, the medium brands, and a representative set of small brands. And then you have a representative set of category entry points. And that's typically might be the top 15 most commonly used in the category. If you measure the relationships between brands and category entry points, you can use that like it's a market of associations, and you work out the share of your brand versus every other brand's, just as you would with sales when people. So if you think of each link to a category entry point as a purchase, yeah, you would add all those purchases up together and go, we got this share of purchases, competitors got this share, and et cetera.
In this channel, we have this amount of this market share. In this channel, we have this amount of market share.
It's more
on the physical.
More think about it in terms of the brains. So the share you have across all of your category buyer brains. So we can get a representation of that in Brand Health Tracker.
I meant the comparison helps, that when you think of physical market share, there's a certain channel and you own, you have a certain turnover in that physical channel. And we can apply that to the mental channel as well. Like basically the category entry point is a channel. And are we available at all there? Are we on the shelf?
I tend not to do that because the problem you have is unlike, so this is where the analogy breaks down, is that you go to a convenience store and buy a stick of gum. You've only bought it in that convenience store. But the act of that buying that gum when it comes to category entry point might have involved three or four category entry points. So you can't treat each category entry point in isolation. They're better off treated as a market of ways that someone can enter into a category.
And we need to measure how many of these points we actually come up with. That's the width of our association network.
Yeah, you don't have to do them all. If you try to do them all, it's crazy. You need to have the most common ones. And I usually find if you have about the top 15, you're covering a big chunk of what's going on in the market. When it comes to brand health tracking, you have to have some practicalities in place because you can only have respondents for periods of time. And the more you tax them, the more, the lower the quality of the data. So we want to make sure we're making it as easy as possible. So in the book, there is all the details on how to do that. But the point I want to make is that overall metric is relevant to all groups. So that's one metric that you can attract there. Underpinning it is three other metrics that define what goes on underneath. So the first one is mental penetration, which is a more sophisticated awareness measure. And what it does is it measures what proportion of category buyers link your brand to at least one category entry point. And so rather than just the brand awareness, which says, I know you sell pet insurance, it's like, oh, I know you sell pet insurance for older dogs. So if I've got an older dog I need to insure, I can come to you and you'll give me a good price for that type of thing. So that you've got more relevant memories attached. So that in itself is a very low bar to go over, just having one out of, say, 15 category entry points. So obviously, brand buyers, they're going to have you linked to at least one. So we don't worry about those. This is a metric that's more relevant to non-buyers and therefore also more relevant to smaller brands, because they're the ones that are most likely to have a lot of non-buyers who don't link them to any category entry points. So rather than three metrics there, it's one. It's just about non-buyers. Network size is another one, which is captures. So that captures how many people you have potentially to buy. Then you want to know how many opportunities you have to buy, wider, fresher networks. And that's where we get to network size. And that is, of those with mental penetration, how many category entry points do they have? How many doorways can you go in? That's also a measure that's relevant to both users and non-users. So you can measure that overall. A final measure is a share of mind, which captures how competitive you are amongst those where you've got a presence. That in itself is only really relevant for big brands. And it's usually where we see decline happening. Because the thing about big brands is when they decline, they don't just fall out of people's brains. It isn't like someone wakes up one day and goes, I no longer know McDonald's exists as a brand. When big brands decline, it's usually because smaller brands are eating away at their memories and just becoming less competitive. And it's usually in share of mind where we pick that up. So if you're a big brand, your focus is on mental market share, network size overall, and share of mind amongst your buyers. If you're a small brand, you have mental market share, mental penetration amongst non-buyers, and network size. So instead of 12 metrics, you've actually got the ones where you're more likely to see the changes that are important to you depending on the context of your brand. And that's what we need to get better at in brand health tracking. It's not about a dashboard that applies to everybody. It's about understanding where your brand is and what changes are likely to happen in people's memories that are likely to be linked to sales.
Right. Well, that was very useful. Thank you. That's really good. I have one example where I had a client once that was the inventor of a certain technology. This is in a business-to-business context. And it grew out of that one technology. And that, because it proves the necessity of innovation, if it is innovation in communication or also technology, because that client actually had this one technology that made up 80, 90% of the market. And then the sales were declining because obviously the competitors were getting stronger. And then he brought out another technological solution, which had only a very, very tiny market share. But again, it was the most superior solution and he created a lot of buzz around it. And there were, you know, like lots of trade shows and so on. And what happened is that his overall turnover was growing. But if you looked at the numbers, not out of that little technological solution that he introduced, but the regular solution suddenly again grew. And that proves your point. Basically, he refreshed the memory structures of, those were the inventors of, and yeah, I can get it anywhere. But somehow I can think of them more quickly when I am in need of that technological solution. So that's a real life proof of what you just said, that it makes complete sense. Could we, because it's always great talking to you, Jenny, and I really enjoy this. We're coming to the end of our episode. So could we do what I suggested in the beginning, yes. Like look at the bank and, sure. and follow a client like to a decision in the banking process, whatever he gets a credit or opens an account and whatever. And then look at how could we see if that, like, how does it turn up in the brand tracking? Like the customer experience. Yeah. That would be great. So, storytelling quality of Jenny Romaniuk at its best. There we go.
Okay. So if you think about the banking business, you basically have two reasons why you use a bank. Either you've got more money than you know what to do with, so you want to put it in there, or you need more money than you have, so you have to go and ask for money. So then you have to think about what are the conditions where either of those things happen. Okay, so that's the first thing, because that's your category entry point. We've got people in situations where they need money that they don't have. And sometimes that can be, for example, I want to buy a house, although I know in Germany you have very different rules about buying houses and home loans and things like that. But, you know, in one of our markets here, it's like, well, particularly nowadays with the explosion of the housing market, I might need to borrow, $900,000 to buy a house. So I don't have $900,000 going along. So I go to a bank, get a home loan that's going to cover that in there. So that's a case where the amount of money I need is way more than I will ever do. And that's an old practice.
But let's stick with that example, because in Germany that's a very big market, and if you look at it in the end, it seems like completely interchangeable. It's all about the interest rate, but that's not true. There are some banks that actually manage to take more interest and even sell more loans.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. So first of all, you have to think about, okay, who offers home loans? Now, in that case, a lot of times that's lots of banks. So we're dealing with a subcategory here, but you might have some other conditions that come out about it. For example, you might have a very checkered history in terms of your repayments. You might have missed a few bills, that sort of thing, not have so great of a credit score or the equivalent, what it is. It varies by country. But basically, when someone does a search on your background, they go, oh, a few red flags here. So that might lead you to think about banks that maybe will be more forgiving of people who've made mistakes in the past. Or it might be that you go, I want to pay this off as quickly as possible, so I want really flexibility in the amount I can repay. Or you might be risk averse and go, no, I want someone that's going to offer me a really great fixed rate so that I can guarantee for the next 5 years I know exactly how much I'm going to pay. I'm not worried about interest rates going up because I want security, because I know I'm going to have some extra expenses because the kids are at school, things like that.
So but let's say we as a bank are interested in the last type, like they will pay back their bank, no checkered history. This is the most valuable customer segment. So how can I see in my brand tracking now if I'm more attractive to this client group?
Well, the first thing you have to do is to tell people this is what you want to be linked to as a bank. So you'd have to develop advertising to say, hey, if you want security in understanding what you're going to be paying for the next 5 years so that, you're not worried about the pressures and the uncertain economic times, you have to communicate that to people so that when people come in with that mindset, you're one of the banks that comes up. You probably won't be the only one. There will be others in there, but you're basically giving yourself the ticket to compete. You're getting into that room to then have that conversation. Once you're in that room, obviously then, yes, you have to have the right interest rate. You have to be competitive in there and all of that sort of stuff. So you still have to have the right portfolio product for someone to do that. I mean, because if someone comes to you and they're thinking that, and it might not be just fixed interest rates. There might be other ways that you can offer certainty of payments. I've just used that as an example, as a common one. So it's about thinking about the mindset of this is what someone's coming in. What's the product we offer that if someone's coming in with this mindset, they would go, oh yeah, this is what, either they'll find it online or they'll talk to a sales rep and sales rep will say, hey, this is the product, or they'll talk to a broker, hey, this is the product. So that's what you need to do. So first of all, you need to build that up in people's memories, and then you also need to have a product for it. In the brand tracker, we will pick up if you've done a successful job of building up in people's memories. Because remember, that requires three components. One is you get the message right. So people see your communication and that's the memory that's built. Secondly, you've got the brand in there. So you're using your distinctive assets, you've got, or you've just got really strong direct branding. So there's unmistakably it's for you. And thirdly, you're doing that in a wide-reaching way that it's having a mass effect, it's having a scale effect. Because if you're already doing, say, a small online campaign that only hits 10 people, we're not going to see that in a brand tracker because it just doesn't have the scale. And this is where, you know, when people go, well, we have to do big samples to see the effects of our small activities. My question is always, why are you doing so many small activities? If they're so small, they won't register on a tracker. Maybe you should rethink, is that a use, good use of your energies? And maybe they should be replaced with things that have bigger scale that can be seen in the tracker.
A good point. So in the tracker, we would see if we reach the threshold with our communication, if the memory structure changes to, with this bank, I have security if I need a loan for buying a
house.
So
if you've got the category entry point in there and you've got the brand in there and you've got a representative set of category entry points and a representative set of brands, another empirical law or empirical pattern that we know is you can actually predict every brand score on every category entry point. You can actually do this for all brand attributes. So we wrote this in a paper Byron and I had published in 2000. It was in the International Journal of Market Research. And since then, there's been a few follow-up papers showing how this works well in terms of detecting advertising effects because it basically removes all the noise and allows you to tell if you definitely scored more. And so you can actually determine. So if you're successfully building that, you will either develop a mental advantage or increase your mental advantage. And a mental advantage is you're thought of by more people as linked to that than you should for a brand of your size on an attribute of that size. Mm-hmm. So if you have a 10 percentage point mental advantage, that means 10 percentage points more people are going to think of you or have a chance of thinking of you than they should. So that gives you a real advantage in the marketplace.
So you need to correct for the big brand effect and then see how
relatively
strong.
Otherwise you just will always see big brands scoring more than small brands. And then always if you're a small brand, you'll go, we're not doing a great job. But you could be doing a really good job for a brand of your size. And as you build that momentum, you can get bigger over time. But you also need to adjust that because what the big problem with a lot of brand trackers now is big brands look good until they don't.
Exactly. And they all pat them on the back.
Yeah,
we are so strong. We are stronger than anybody else.
But why are our sales going down? Someone in the back room will ask. And you go, well, that's because you're not controlling for size when you're determining your results. You're saying, we're scoring great. We're scoring better than everyone else. But that's different from, are you scoring better, worse, or as you should for a brand of your size?
That is the perfect setup for my last question because, okay, so I read Brand Health, Better Brand Health. I learned so much and I realized, oh, we got to change things. How do you actually make people that track their brands for 10, 15 years the same way? What is the key argument to say, okay, we really got to break this up and change? Because my experience is that the brand trackers just become bigger and bigger and bigger. They measure more and more and more. What is your experience there? And can you give a tip of the person that has seen the light and want to convert the organization?
Yeah, it's hard because people are always like, well, but we don't lose continuity. My thing is that sometimes you can evolve because sometimes, for example, you might have a long attribute list of which some of them are category entry points. And in which case, you know, it might not be a case of throwing everything out, but getting rid of some stuff that's totally irrelevant. So there is a process, there's a lot of R&D that can be done to look at what's savable amongst your tracker. And so, you know, I mean, we offer that service. There's other people who can do it as well. But it is something that, you know, if you're going, we want to make sure we can save as much as possible, then it is possible to have a look and see what is. I mean, I just did a review for a company and it came back and they said, Oh, you've just cut out about a third of our tracker. And I went, yep, because you don't need to measure that anymore. But there are some things in here where I went, okay, this you can do with this change, you can keep this. For example, they were measuring like service quality type things in their tracker. I said, put that in your service quality satisfaction tracker, but put a time frame on it. Because if you've got a time frame of the experience, you're getting fewer people, but you're getting better quality data because they've all experienced around the same time. Versus if you have a longer time frame, you might have people, you have 6 months, you have some people for whom it was 6 months ago, some people for whom it was yesterday. Our memories are different of those two types of experiences. You get more heterogeneity in the data. It's very hard to see the patterns and understand, are you genuinely doing better or not? So sometimes there are little changes that can actually improve the overall quality of your data, but don't throw everything out. Sometimes there is a requirement. One of the big problems with a lot of trackers is often they're measuring the same thing of how big the brand is or how much people like the brand or both multiple times. And you can go, well, you're measuring the same thing five times. How about we get rid of four of those and just focus on one? So there's lots of things you can do to improve the quality of it. If you do feel like you need to start from scratch or you want to see what that looks like, on my website, I've actually got a Word template of the questionnaire that you can download and then start filling it in of if you were starting from scratch, this is what it would look like that then you can compare side by side. And there's also some Excel spreadsheets that have the calculations I've talked about for how do you calculate a mental advantage, how do you calculate mental availability metrics that so people can easily follow the formula and go, oh, okay, it's actually not that complicated. Because all of the stuff I talk about can be done in Excel, essentially. You don't need fancy statistical programs for it.
That's a great resource. We're going to put the link in the show notes. Also for companies that might have not done brand tracking in the past, the smaller ones. And so that's
Yeah,
a
I
great
really
starting
wanted
point.
to open source it such that people could take ownership of it. The analysis is really quite easy if you've got a little bit of a little bit of a math statistical brain, you can do it. And so, in some cases, maybe you can do it yourself if you're that way inclined. But if nothing else, you can at least get a questionnaire together to go to an experience provider and go, this is the kind of thing I want. And you know exactly what it is you're looking for. And that allows you then, and this is what I tried to do in the book as well, is to give you informed questions. If someone comes back with a different approach, you can ask why and check that it will work for what it is you need.
That's excellent. Thank you very much. That leaves me my last question, which you know already. If you, on the topic of brand tracking, if you could put something on everybody's computer screen involved in managing brands, what would that sentence be?
Oh, it'd be the mantra.
The
Design for the
mantra is, let's
category,
repeat it.
analyze for the brand. Yeah, design for the category, analyze for the brand, analyze for the buyer, report for the brand.
Okay, design for the
Yeah.
category. Analyze for the buyer and report for the brand.
Yeah,
Thank
because
you.
that encapsulates everything that makes a tracker good if you control for those things.
That's fantastic. Thank you very, very much for your time, Jenny, for your great insight, for your openness, and also getting like this open source platform for thinking about better brand health and how to track the strength of our brand. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Und das war eine weitere Episode von Markenkraft. Vielen Dank, dass Sie dabei waren. Wir hoffen, es hat Ihnen genauso viel Freude gemacht wie uns. Wenn ja, empfehlen Sie uns, Ihren Freunden, Ihren Bekannten, Ihren Kollegen und bewerten Sie uns auf iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, egal wo Sie diesen Podcast hören. Share the love for brands. Machen Sie es gut für sich und die Menschen in Ihrem Leben.